Welcome to Belt Unloaded, the officially unofficial podcast for The Expanse on Amazon Prime. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 6, Episode 2, titled The Azure Dragon. Aaron, I don't know about you, but I enjoyed this episode.
Oh yeah, I enjoyed this episode a lot. It's becoming clear to me that this is going to be a very movie-like three-act structure, or at least that's what it seems like. Because the one thing that impressed me in my rewatch of The Expanse is, like, what a fucking momentum this show has. And that, like, almost every hour they're managing to have a fairly big cliffhanger. Like, you know, like, oh my god, what's going to happen next? This season, it doesn't seem like they're doing that. It seems like it's very much conventionally, like, an arc. Like, you know, it wasn't a cliffhanger. We knew what Apisaral was going to suggest. I mean, not exactly, but like...
Yeah, I don't think they gave you enough information to really know.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you know, they got this, the fucking spotter ship. They got the Rocinante with their small crew. They got Bobby Draper, walking tank. Like, you know, they're the intelligence crew.
These pieces fit together in a certain way, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And at the end of this, like, it's a little bit of... It's not really a cliffhanger. It's the villain reacting to the thing that happened in the first act and saying, oh, well, we're going to have Empire Strike, you know, we're going to have a Inaro Strikes Back kind of situation when the Belters, or when the Inners try to retake Ceres. So it's like, it's not a cliffhanger. It's just handing the ball off to the next act. That's not a criticism. I mean, that's just like, you know, that's a pretty classical structure. But I thought it's real good. Like, they're finding ways, like, the crew is starting to, like, deal with their shit. The stuff that they're dealing with made a lot of sense. I really liked, you know, like, when Naomi had the panic attack going out, like, that makes a lot of sense after her, you know, adventures on the Chainsmoker last year. And the space battle, the chase was thrilling. Yeah. Like, you know, Bobby got to do cool Bobby shit. Peaches got to do cool Melba shit. I liked it. And you said you did too. So,
I mean, that space battle was kind of awesome. I liked seeing a little more finesse from the crew. They can't just, like, fire 600, PDC rounds into this thing. They have to figure out a way to match it. And I love too that you had some people not strapped in to crash couches. They were just on the deck, and Amos is being squashed and Naomi's being squashed. And then you've got Belters on the other ship who, you know, can't take the G's that a human could take. And it's like, okay, which one of these things is going to win? You know, there are, like, a lot of variables in that. And to me, that was super exciting.
Yeah, I thought it was really well done. I am shocked. I'm really shocked we went back to Laconia for the further adventures of the cute kid.
This is
and her alien menagerie.
Yeah, the one gripe I have about this episode, the season so far, I don't know why this is important in any way.
And this
is really going to have to pay off to not make it a waste of, like, 5 or 6 minutes at this point.
It still feels to me like this is the future of The Expanse, and, like, I'm surprised they're devoting so much to it when they are, by all accounts, prepared to drop this, like, the hottest of potatoes at the end of the season.
Yeah, like, still to
it really
to this day,
feels
we don't
know. To me that they are counting on the fact that there's going to be a miniseries or a movie or offer or something in their future. And again, I don't know. I'm getting nervous because we're recording this in a vacuum. We're just recording these back to back, and it's just me and Jim locked in a room with our fears talking. But, like, it just seems insane to. But it seems insane to me that no one would pick this property up. But on the other hand, like, I don't know. Since last night, I guess I've been thinking about what you've been saying about, you know, what is the actual evidence that this is, like, this is this now starting to feel like posturing from the production team, like, wanting, you know, like, hey, yeah, there's more story, but, like, who is the one that's taking? I don't know whether people are waiting to see how this final book is received, because that's important. If this final book if is, like, meh or worse, then I'd feel significantly more bearish on this thing's options. But on the other hand, it just came out today. And if we get in the next 24 to 48 hours, like, positive thumbs up from the fan base, then I just can't believe someone's going to sit and have an unproduced trilogy with a built-in fan base.
It's
whatever size you think that fan base is.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see. I'm fully expecting,
you know,
but by the time that this airs, like 2 weeks, 3 weeks from now or whatever, they will have either said, yeah, we're totally dropping it. We have no plans to renew, or they'll have said, yeah, we're renewed for another three seasons. I doubt that, but.
See, I think that only happens if Amazon picks it up. I think what'll happen is
there'll be another Save the Expanse, and you'll have to go out there without Cass Anbar making the connections.
And then in that case, like, it might take a year. But, like, man, it's I don't know what is it, Skydance? I don't know, like, because somebody was talking about, like, you know, the scary thing about a significant hiatus is like what happens to the sets, what happens to the costumes, like that shit starts to get broken down. That stuff starts to get starts to get thrown into the wood chipper to make space for other productions.
Yeah.
You know, like, and there's significant investments in that. And like, if another that makes it less likely because, you know, there's going to have to be all that work done again.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do if the cast starts to, and, you know, I don't know. I don't know. But again, two episodes in, this is so good, I don't want it to end.
And of course, yeah. I think we're all feeling that. It's
and that's what's really settling
season
in.
Lows.
Is like, we're a third of the way done.
Uh-huh.
We're already a third of the way
done. I know, man. It's great. And we've done these, like you said, back-to-back over 2 days, so it really feels shortened for us.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
I hope
I'm
going to
be sad.
I haven't, I'm not 100%, like, I'm pretty sure, I mean, we just surmise that as short as the season is, and I think the Wikipedia and the IMDb airing, like, it doesn't seem like going to double up, but holy cow, if they doubled up and got, like, the first two episodes out, it's like, whew, 5 weeks, you're done.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
No.
Anyway, yeah, do we want to talk more preamble stuff, or should we get right into the episode?
Let's get into the episode, but real quick, let's take a break. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. the thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Okay, this week's episode begins with the further adventures of adorable little girl from Laconia, having quite frankly terrifying experiences with completely alien life forms, totally unsupervised. My dad reflexes and instincts are completely on overdrive and it's killing me. What do you think of this scene, Jim?
I don't know what to think of this scene, man. It's not a bad scene. It just doesn't feel like it's doing anything. Like, it's introducing a new character on a strange planet, but, and that might be exciting if I felt like it were going somewhere, but how is it connected to anything else that we think is going on Laconia? How is it connected to proto-molecule stuff? Like, what are they doing with this? Because they're spending an awful lot of time on this girl kind of trying to understand the wildlife of this planet. And help the wildlife of this planet? There's some message there that I'm just not getting.
There's stuff in the background happening for sure. But like, sure. I started talking about parents, the foreground first. Like, you know, I was wondering, like, what are they going last week? Is this like some kind of War of the Worlds? The girl coughed on these things and now they're going to die. I don't know why I didn't think about it. It's the food she fed, you know, and her mom and dad have to explain. I think that's laying groundwork for probably some kind of alien thing. But again, that seems like
why?
Season 7, yeah. You know, a hypothetical, fantastical season 7. There is some stuff. There is some dialogue where the dad breaks in from the girl's hysterics about killing these sunbirds or whatever they're called, and says the soldiers have called a meeting. All settlers have to attend. The mother then goes off camera again, and this is all in the background. I had to crank my TV up to hear it. We have nothing to do, the mother says, but we have nothing to do with whatever they're building up in the orbit. And if they want to help, the least they can do is open up the comms relays to let us know what's going on back home.
Mm-hmm. So let's watch the parents for 6 minutes in a 43-minute episode. Let's do that instead of watching this little girl.
That tells us a couple things. Like, there is, you know, that we knew this last episode, I guess, is that the Marco has shut down communications through the ring gate. We now know that this is going both ways, and the colonists on these other planets know about it. Mm-hmm. So they know about what's being built, but they, like, you know, that's one thing I was wondering is, like, is everyone on Laconia like on mission as the fucking captain that wanted to, you know, give his subordinate 50 lashes for having a bracelet that reminded her of his mother? You know, like, are they all that crazy? It doesn't seem like it. It seems like there's just a lot of scientists and civilians on this Spartan super Martian soldier program, which I think is interesting. But again, I'm with you. I don't know where it's going for.
I mean, it's got to be doing stuff that's in books 7, 8, 9 somewhere. And then they are going. I mean, none of this stuff is in book 6. This is a novella. Like I said, when last episode, when we talked about Strange Dogs. That's the name of the novella, but like, it's a novella for a reason, right? It's not mainline. It's not critical to the story. So what are we doing spending,
I don't know,
6 minutes out of a 43-minute episode that is one of 6 in the entire final season? This time seems very important and this plot seems very irrelevant.
Like we talked about, this is like a football season. Every fucking minute feels like it matters. And like, what are they spending this on?
This is the last 30 seconds of a basketball game where everybody's calling timeout. Everybody's getting free throws in. And this little girl's just dancing around on the court. And people are watching her instead of the game. I don't get it.
What's happening? I did like when she was running pell mell through the forest with the dying bird in her hand, her stepping in front of the armored golf cart. And this guy's ADR, hey, watch it, kid. It sounds like some guy, you know, like I don't know, a sitcom set, and you know, a kid is running out, honk.
Yeah,
what are you trying to walk here? Like, it's this close to I'm walking here scene on an alien world. It's a first for humanity. The other thing is, like, I just can't get over, like, this seems just so menacing. Like, this girl turning her back on this giant frog thing, and it's creeping up on her. I'm like, what's this going to eat her? It's just going to fucking eat her whole. And then it eats the other. So it's carnivorous. But like, I don't know. Is this going to be like, are they telling a story of a complete biome collapse? Because she's going to feed this thing tainted meat, and it's going to fall into the ocean and get swallowed by whatever the version of shark. It's just going to fucking just destroy the Laconian biosphere. Do they care? Because the other thing is, apparently,
good question,
none of their life chemistry is compatible, so we can't eat any of them for food. They can't eat any of us for food. Like, it's,
yeah, I thought that stuff was interesting, but
I'm just shocked. I thought carbon-based life would have a lot more things in common as far as what they can put in their mouth.
Yeah, I would have too. Like, clearly it's carbon-based because the atmosphere is breathable by humans. So, like,
so. Right.
You kind of are going to have similar organisms developing, I would think. But what do I know?
Yeah, I don't know either. But yeah, I'm curious, because apparently this is just going to be the intro of every episode, is what I'm going to guess is going to happen from here on out. So little girl, we'll wait to see here. It feels like a serial, though, like a short that opens up a feature, you know?
Yeah. And maybe it'll come around. I guess four more episodes. So
this is true. This is true. So Rocinante gets more fuel, more food, more water, more bullets from a UNN supply ship. And also a surprise mission specialist. If you fell asleep in the last 5 minutes, last episode, you might be surprised, but we're not. One former Martian recon Marine, Roberta Draper, reporting for duty.
Yeah, that wasn't the biggest surprise to me in this episode, because, of course, we kind of saw that coming. This scene's biggest surprise, Holden calling Clarissa Mao Peaches. I was not joking about this less than one day ago. I was joking about how Holden would never call her Peaches. They are so far from that. There's no possible way. And then here it is, very next episode. For me, very next, the same evening, because I watched this last night, here is Holden calling her Peaches, unironically.
You're like, you're like the meme of the guy eating a bowl of cereal. He's never going to call her Peaches next frame, spitting it out. Yeah.
Right?
Holy shit. The way they played it was funny, too, because Holden's like, it's like, you know, like dirty laundry falling out of his mouth. Like, he kind of like, Peaches, you know, like he can't believe he's saying it.
I couldn't either. It was wild.
I mean, why? You know, there's the option of calling her Clarissa.
Yeah, Claire. Claire. Call her Claire, like everybody else did. Yeah,
Miss Mao. You know, there's lots of options besides Peaches. And I think that's the other thing, is it kind of surprised him. He's like, I've heard nothing Peaches the last 6 months.
True,
it's pretty funny.
I will say, you know, in a 6-episode season, you probably don't have a lot of time to pussyfoot around. What's he going to call her, and how are they going to repair this relationship? Yeah. And they do a little bit. They do probably most of what they're going to do in this episode, with bridging the gap between Holden and her.
I think it works. I'm gonna talk about it more later, because, you know, they haven't actually done the thing yet, but I like the you know, the merchant marine, I guess, supply officer being like, oh, isn't this nice, we're dropping off Mickey ammo and a belter nice? Pirate ship kind of.
It's great to see everybody working together, but what he really is saying is, now we all have a common enemy that we can go kill. That's what he's really saying. And he's also
there's still an us and them, and the them is the belter, and you've got a belter in the scene. So at least he didn't use the S slur.
Right.
Like Bull was thrown around last season. But
then hell yeah, Bobby comes in and she's towing her suit in that case, and I'm just like, oh, things are gonna get good.
I wanna say, because I know I've talked some shit. I've talked some shit about the zero gravity work on this show before. And I will say that, like, again, recently rewatching the whole series, I was kind of blown away by how above average the zero G work is.
Mm-hmm.
I think what drives me crazy is every once in a while, there'll be like the focus on a wrong extra, or sometimes even main cast members that are not doing, you know, like I said, like I think at one point, like Ashford leans against a console in zero G, and I'm like, that's just stupid. Like, that shouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. They do, on the whole, really good work. We talked about Amos's Mario Galaxy experience last episode. Holden just gliding down the staircase like a vampire.
Yeah.
I fucking loved it. And like you said, Bobby Carton, like an entire Martian arsenal just with fingertip control.
Yeah.
That stuff is really cool. And it's stuff they're doing that's not even showy. It's just, if you didn't pay attention to Holden's feet, you just might think he's walking down the thing. But mm-hmm. like, just grace notes like that, and then just nailing it, I think are great.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it does. Like, I liked how that Holden was happy to see Bobby,
mm-hmm.
but also kind of frowny face at the amount of weapons and armor that she's bringing in, and like, what does this mean,
you know,
for the Rocinante? Because he's the captain, he's worried.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Philip is cooling his heels in a series clink when his father comes to bail him out.
There's a conversation here between Marco and Philip, one that looks like it might not have happened if things didn't go exactly this way, where Marco is essentially saying to him he's an embarrassment, which is interesting. Or he's the words he uses make it sound as if he's concerned about Philip's reputation, but what he's actually concerned about is his own reputation. And I think there are a couple of scenes in this episode that show that. The other scene is the one about like the definition of love that we'll get to later. Both of these scenes, and I think we know this about Marco, he's more concerned with his own image than anyone else, including Philip. Oh, yeah. And this scene reflects that.
And he also manipulates and emotionally abuses the people he loves. That's how he kept Naomi under his thumb. And the book, by the way, book five is really good at showing, like, you know, how much, you know, long lasting damage he did to her. But Philip is getting, you know, we talked about this a lot last season, that like Philip is just getting it from both ends. He's both mm-hmm. like, you know, a 16-year-old dealing with this delusions of grandeur that his father's blowing into his head, and then also dealing with his father's mercurial temperament and, you know, inability to let, you know, him be be his own person. Like, he wants him to be a miniature version of himself, and whenever he breaks out of that mold or disappoints him, or, you know, it's like just not just bringing him back to earth, but just these vicious attacks on his manhood and
mm-hmm.
and all that. And it's more the same. I did think there's a couple things interesting. I like that, you know, again, as this is the end of a series of The Expanse, if not the series, this is the end of the second trilogy. And I like how many callbacks. It's like we had the Belter provocateur from the first episode and the last episode. You know, we begin with Miller and as a Star Helix agent on Ceres. Well, we see Philip sitting in a Star Helix jail cell, and the logo's nice. Been defaced with an OPA symbol. Yeah, like, there's so many nice callbacks to season one in this allegedly final season that I liked it a lot. The other thing is, if we didn't know it before, Marco really doesn't give a shit about any part of the belt that's not the Free Navy. Like,
right.
He completely runs roughshod over the station administrator. The laws do not apply to him and his crew.
Mm-hmm.
And that should be chilling if you're an administrator trusting on this guy to feed your people.
Yeah.
And make sure you get needed supplies during the easy part of the campaign. Again, that's the other thing, is like, he has been able to do whatever the fuck he wants for like the last 6 to 9 months. And things are going to get significantly harder now after this episode. But, yeah, I don't know. And that's the other thing, is like, I feel like there is also some daylight between what he says to, like, about him and Sin, how like, oh, we drank and we had someone different every night, but every morning we were back on the line because there was nobody. And then I think someone else is telling a story about, you know, in the old days when he's actually talking to his lieutenant, he's saying back in the old days, like, they would sleep through their shift on the line because they were so, So he's like bull, and this is common to parents. Like you, and I think it's a mistake to offer yourself up as a paragon. When I was your age, I did everything right, and you're stupid. You're doing everything wrong. Bull fucking shit.
Yeah,
that's never the case. So there's a little bit of the big heaping helping of that if you're paying attention to the dialogue of him bullshitting his own son about how awesome he was back in the day, and it just makes Philip feel inadequate. I mean, I feel like that's the performance we're getting out of this kid at the end of the scene. So Bobby briefs the crew of the Rocinante on their new mission, and afterwards Holden expresses some of his fears he has about the ring eating Martian ships.
Yeah, several Martian ships have disappeared. It's not just the Barkeith from last season. It's several, according to Bobby. And I guess we'll get more information about that. Bobby's going to get her some, or get Holden some intel. That'll be good. Although they get a lot of intel this episode.
Yeah, and I also think that like there's also, I think, room, like, because like I think what Bobby's saying about like we just assumed a lot of these were rogue Martian ships that went to slink off the Marco. I bet that's what a lot of them are. Like I don't think that literally every one of the ships that like the Mars is tracked is going to be eaten by the thing. But it does make you wonder, why is the ring gate selectively eating some? Why is it not just like eating all of them to go through a certain gate? Why is, you know, like what is going on that's maybe increasing the activity? There's a bunch of questions I had in my mind.
Yeah. No, I hope we get some answers. We'll see.
It's interesting, the scene where Bobby's briefing the crew. It's a war between the crew's kind of war-weary cynicism and Bobby's kind of like recruiting poster,
right?
Rah, rah, rah. I think the truth is a little bit in between. I think Avis Rala, as you know, just watching through the series, watching, that's one of the things that really brought Avis Rala down in the early seasons, is that ill-fated strike. There's definitely like, yeah, the crew of Rocinante, the wild cards, the people just go around pushing buttons and fucking shit up in the solar system. Like if you hear that they tried some daring raid on some Marco facility and they got their ass blasted, that's just a Rocinante. If it's crew of UN Marines going in there and getting spanked, then it's like it's another failure of the Earth government. Right.
Uh-huh.
So. Yeah. And that's good politics, honestly. You can't have Earth falling apart at a time like this. So you need them to have faith in the government, or it's just going to, you know, whatever death toll, whatever starvation, whatever kind of lawlessness and loss of life is just going to be 10 times greater if like the churn really sets in, you know?
Oh, yeah. Mother of all churns.
Yeah. But they also got, I like knowing, and boy, this has been increasingly rare in prestige television of late, or good television, but like, I like knowing the fucking plan as it is and how it's supposed to go before we I'm like Holden. I like knowing the plan before we start deviating from it. And a lot of shows like, you know, just prefer to like, you know, everyone knows the plan except for the audience. So, you know, anything can be a surprise. Anything can be a plan. Anything can be. And I like the scene of like, yeah, this is how it's supposed to happen.
Yeah, they play a lot with that, the idea of like what is the plan and what happens when the plan changes, and did the plan ever change? There's a bit of like 1984. We were always at war with whatever Asia going on in this episode. And I'll talk about it when we get to the Marco scenes, because he is kind of known for doing that.
Mm hmm. Yeah, and I also really liked Amos's reaction. Like so much of what Amos does is just for being funny in the margins. But you know, him like, is anyone getting paid extra for this? And you know, Bob's like, I'm not in for pay. And Amos just like triple take at like, what is? And then when Bobby tries to shine him on, he's like, you know what? Fuck all of you people. I'm gonna roll a grenade into the mess area here. And like, hey. Here's Clarissa Mao, wanted mass murderer. Say hi. Talk to Holden about it. Peace. Mm-hmm. Like, it's great. It's great.
Yeah.
So anyway, we move on to Drummer ship Tynan. This is, of course, we'll know this by the end of the episode. But this is the ghost knife of the belt. This is Ashford Kloss's famous. This is like Blackbeard's ship, you know, like this, the Queen Anne's Revenge. This is a storied ship in the belt. And they really sell that in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Drummer's forced to meet with a quite Lando Calrissian type figure, Liang Walker, on board his ship to Irizami, having no safer option to get her wayward crew member Michio off her ship. Like I said, this guy is very Lando-ish. He is going to either serve a very important role in Drummer's guerrilla war against Marco, or he might sell her out to him. And
yeah,
I just hope he has the common courtesy to act real bad and mutter things like this deal keeps getting worse all the time while he's doing it.
Sure. In his like Scottish belter. I don't know what his accent is. There's a little bit of some like Sean Connery-esque thing going on there, too.
A little bit.
Yeah,
a little bit.
I liked it. I didn't have a problem, but
I assume unique. This guy's a character in the book. Yes. No.
No.
No. Really? Okay. Is he not a do you not recognize him as a composite of do you
no.
just recognize the really? Okay. Because
yeah.
I was like, yeah, my how close on the Lando scale am I? Because it does seem like this guy is.
I can't tell you.
He is the obvious ally, but also hidden threat. Could go either way. I like him.
Mm-hmm. I do too. And he seems like.
I like an old grizzled belter. Yeah.
He's a decent pirate, right? He's not like one of the pirates that's going to, I don't know, swashbuckle you. Sure. That's a thing pirates do.
Well, he has no love for the Empire. I mean, he has no love for Marco. I can tell you that much.
For sure. Yeah.
Probably a good way. Probably a good place to hole up and get your Millennium Falcon fixed or steal your Macho Peru.
Yeah. Until he alters the deal and then you're fucked.
Yeah.
I was super worried that they were going to put Michio into this pirate's hands and that seems super dangerous, but, or I guess he's a smuggler or was a smuggler. I don't know. He's Han Solo and Lando Calrissian rolled into one.
He is. Well, I mean, Han Solo is Lando. Lando mm-hmm. is Han. They're very similar.
But I don't know if that's the case even by the end of this. We'll see. Because there's a second portion to this scene where Drummer gives him the tour of the ship and they get to talking more and some things change,
we'll
I think.
There.
But we'll get there.
But I like this because like so far we've introduced the two classes of belter. One that just is wildly enthusiastic about Marco and Aros and what he's doing. And the people who are dead or that he wants dead.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a third class of belter that, might have some skepticism about, Marco. Like it is wild because I'd forgotten this in season 4, but there's this whole scene where Drummer and Ashford has Marco in an airlock about to space him, and Drummer turns out to be a political miscalculation. I thought it was smart at mm-hmm. the time. Spares him, to play a bigger political game. But like Marco was never like popular with every faction in the belt. And now we're seeing how like, you know, what it's like to have a Navy, half of the people that might mistrust you, not have some grievances. You're exploitable. Everything's great when things are going well for you and you seem like you're the golden child. But, you know, as you start getting some military reversals, I wonder how many of these kind of lone wolf types will start slinking off from the pack.
And I do wonder how difficult it's going to make it for Earth to tell the difference, or for the inners, Earth and Mars, to tell the difference. Because like there's a lot of
they're all belters,
wiggle
right?
room, right? They're all belters to them, kind of.
Right.
B, even if they were to distinguish and then have a nuanced view of the belters, that could easily provide cover for the Free Navy to slip in and fuck shit up.
Sure, because
they could just say no, we're not loyal to Marco, and then boom, here they are behind your lines, doing things. So it's gonna get complicated.
It's tough being in a civil war. It's tough being an ally to someone in the civil war. It's just tough all around.
Another thing I pulled out of this scene, it's just kind of like some quick dialogue here and there, is that Marco has started pulling supplies off of Ceres and Ganymede, which we know is like the breadbasket of the belt, essentially, and putting them in supply depots around the solar system.
Exactly.
All over the belt. So what image does that conjure in your head? What do you think is going on there?
Well, so in the next scene, which we can get into, Marco pours over a map of these depots that we just talked about, trying to figure out a way to divert supplies to the Medina station even faster.
Mm-hmm.
He is doing some big project at the Medina station involving some type of cooperation with the Laconians is what I'm putting together. And I suspect it's protomolecule technology based. I suspect there's going to be a sudden and inevitable betrayal of the by the Laconians to Marco or vice versa. But yeah, but I think the Laconians, like, they wanted that. They like the Laconians, like, hey, yeah, shut the door behind us.
Yeah,
like,
don't let anybody protection, through. For sure. Yeah. They're the bouncer, right? The Marco's their bouncer.
But I remember that scene of the last season of Expanse where the Martian admiral that ends up getting eaten by the gate was talking about like the unique defensive position of the gate and all that. And I don't think that was all to set up the final the battle to take the ring, which in the books is a political coup. Like Marco just gets some insiders in there and they just take it from underneath Fred Johnson. There's no battle for it.
Right.
But yeah, I'm not sure what the fucking Martian's plan was. It seems to me, if I was guessing, that they wanted to be shut off from everything else in their system with the Kodazar. I think that's the name of the psychotic or sociopathic, you know, scientist that's a protomolecule specialist. Mm-hmm. While he builds them a whole bunch of outlandish future weaponry and build them up into the Mars that they always wanted to be, this tough, indefeatable or invincible military force. And then they go take the gate and reclaim the system by force.
Yeah, which I guess Marco is just hoping that when that happens, they don't turn on him. Because that's a very short-sighted play for Marco, if he's willing to protect them without any real leverage. Like, once they build those protomolecule ships, we saw one. That thing doesn't look like it could be challenged by anything Earth's got, let alone the belt.
Probably not. It's so huge.
Yeah, so huge. Like, it seems short-sighted to just think, yeah, we'll protect you while you build this massive army, and then please don't use it on us when you come back.
Yeah, and I always thought it was telling the scale of the ring. Like, I'm thinking, like, you know, like, we've got Panamax class merchant ships, and they're called that because they're exactly as big as what can fit through the Panama Canal. That's essentially a hard limit on how big ships can be, unless you're just running, like, you know, something from Japan to the California back.
Sure.
The rings are fucking huge. Like, massive. I remember watching one of Medina Station going through, me and Jack, and there's a close-up of Medina, well, I guess at the time is the Behemoth. And I'm like, man, look how big that is. And then they go and they do a wide shot, and it's just like, it looks like a soda straw going through an extra, extra large Taco Bell cup, you know? Like,
right?
The size of ship that can fit through this thing, I've always thought that must be one of the final, that might be the final shot of this season, is like just a fucking 90% max size of ship coming through into the solar system, and what the fuck do you do about that?
Right. Right.
Does Marco have his own protomolecule, or is he stupid enough that he gave all of the belt's protomolecule to the Martians?
Maybe he does. I don't know. That would be a thing I would want to split. But also, if he does, he doesn't seem to be using it for anything.
He,
like,
doesn't,
he's
have the
way behind
that can unlock it.
The research curve.
Like, it's kind of like a bio terror weapon. Whereas the Martian faction seems to be making it to super weapons.
It's only a bio terror weapon as long as they don't understand it well enough to defeat it, right? Like,
right.
Your researchers could probably figure out a way to either nullify it or to use it to your advantage or something if you try to unleash that on him. So,
plus, I don't, it's like, also, is protomolecule that dangerous? Like, it was dangerous because it was trying to build the gate. Like, that was the work it was trying to do. Mm-hmm. Like, when the protomolecule doesn't have anything to do, it seems to be content to sit there dormant, not doing anything.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't even know if you, like, start firing protomolecule into, like, wouldn't it just, like, talk to the other protomolecule and be like, hey, there's nothing to do, go back to sleep.
Maybe that's what they're doing on Laconia. They're getting all this, like, feeding an ecosystem poison thing to then turn around and feed it protomolecule because they've got new life forms to deal with.
Yeah, and they figured out how to, like, direct the protomolecule rather than just, because they never did. They just figured out how. They barely figured out what it was trying to do before it just did it, you know? Mm-hmm. So anyway,
we'll see.
There's a discussion to Depot, but this also turns into a discussion with his second officer. You said is Renfield?
Rosencrantz and Gilder Stern.
We kind of talked about this before, you know, cause she's a rough and tough belter, and she got thrown into a recycler tank, which seems pretty horrific for some kind of, and they talk about, you know, like the nature of love, I thought this was all actually pretty good and telling.
Yeah.
Because like at the rock at the bottom, what Marco needs his son to be is what he needs him to be. You know, like he needs him to be mm-hmm. like this perfect belter, you know, the obvious heir to the throne, his strong right hand man. And it's such a contrast because the other, you know, epic sci-fi thing I saw, was much of epic sci-fi because there's tons of epic sci-fi right now. But Dune, like you contrast like Duke Leto's conversation with his son, where it's like, you know, at the end of the day, all I need you to be is my son and your success. Yes. If you do that, you compare that to like the shit that Marco is throwing on Philip. And it's night and day.
I mean, it's just so clear that when he says he loves Philip, what he means is he loves what Philip could be for his reputation. He loves him egotistically, right?
He's classic narcissist. Like, you're a feather in my cap, and if you're an ugly feather, then fuck you. I don't need you.
Right.
I'd rather you not be born. Like, whoa.
Yeah.
What's an ugly feather? You know, like, whose standard are we talking about, Dad? Yeah, right? Yeah.
No, it's wild. He's clearly abusing Philip here.
I thought it was telling too that Rosenfeld threw in that maybe like in the litany of things that this could be. It's like, you know, could you pity him? Could you miss him? Could you envy him? And there seems to be some obvious sexual tension between Rosenfeld and Marco.
I think
so. Like, you know, him being fascinated. Everyone else here is afraid of me because I'm the great Marco. And she's like, this is very almost tropey. But I think it's, you know, this person's been cast as like, you know, an alt pinup girl. Mm-hmm. She is super sexy and in exactly the same way that Marco is. Like, Marco is an alt pinup dude, right?
Sure.
You know, and there's something I also noticed this about this in the characterization this episode. Like, the neck tattoo has always been like synonymous with like the old school belter, right? You know, you got the old school belters that actually had the scars around their neck from their old shitty suits burning them. The new belters have a tattoo shaped like that to like harken back to be like, yeah, we're old school like these guys. She's got like the barbed wire twisted version of that, like and it feels like a real hard flex. Like,
sure,
I'm not just a belter with a neck. I'm a belter with like fucking razor blades and shit sticking out of my neck scar. And it feels like she's very much like Marco. She's a lot of sizzle, and I'm not seeing the steak yet.
No, okay. I mean, she's clearly the one who's like running everything behind the scenes, right? And we haven't gotten a glimpse necessarily behind those scenes yet, so I don't know how good she is at that. But I don't know, maybe it's just her physical presence in this, but I'm getting like very big Cara Dune vibes from her, like from Mandalorian.
But she's competent and she's got a lot of stake. And I compared this to like Sin and Carol from last episode. Like, those people were like extremely old school belters that would take no shit and were like fucking hard as nails, all that kind of stuff. I'm not getting that from her. I'm getting her that she's very into the aesthetic of that, but I don't know how much of that is just making her sexy so that her and Marco can get, because it seems like they're destined to, and how much of that is them trying to deliberately characterize her as kind of like a dabble. Like this is the kind of stuff that Julie Mao would get up to if she hadn't have gotten protomoleculed, you know? Like,
I guess I don't know that we've seen anything like so far. It's all about the look, but we just don't know.
Like, oh, I had to swim in a recycler because I was such a badass, you know, like it's all talk. We haven't seen her do anything.
Exactly. That's what I mean. Like, show me something that she can do that will impress me. And I'll believe it. But until I see the opposite, I'm not going to like discount it. I'm just going to say, okay, well, this seems like a person who to be reckoned with. So let me take her seriously.
It's also I get a lot of lazy. Like, I think of Marco as being pretty lazy in terms of like big picture stuff and important stuff. Like, he's like there for the flash and for the photo ops, but not for like the hard work. And I get a lot of the same from her. Like, you know, oh, gee, it's too hard to feed her people and do this ambitious military project. Let's not even try to do both. Let's just fucking divert everything over to the military project and fuck. It's just like everything is just kind of the lazy, expedient, selfish thing with her and Marco. And they're kind of two peas in a pod.
I didn't get that she was doing it because she's lazy. I thought she was doing it because she genuinely doesn't give a shit about these people and thinks that the military victory is what brings them. The same reason Marco does it. It's what brings him glory, right? But
that's she might extend it to the belt a little. Just laziness and neglect. But
sure.
But yeah, they're two peas in a pod is what I'm getting at.
For sure.
I don't know how much of that is baked into her appearance or not. There's also a lot of great scenes where they're discussing Philip in like a very patronizing kind of like way. Yeah. Philip dealing with his very real like trauma, going through videos and pictures of his friend. And, you know, there's that damn crocodile vest. He's going to be wearing that next episode, right?
I don't think put it back in the box. I was expecting him to because he wears it in the book, but
it needs to stay in the box, Philip. Yeah. Don't get it back out. Got a bullet hole in it now. You don't want it.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, as a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
So we move on to Drummer giving Walker a tour of the Tynan, and she tries stoking the piratical fire in his belly. I think trying to convince and or entice him into betraying Marco and robbing him blind.
Yep, it seems like it. She understands that he knows some of the location of the depots, I guess, and that he would be a valuable ally if she were trying to make a big score against Marco. Yeah, no, it's...
She needs supplies. Marco needs disrupting.
Uh-huh. this is Michio territory. This is kind of where I always thought Tremor was going after season five. The other thing about this is, does this change where Michio is going to end up? Is she going to stay on the ship? Because, like, if they go off fighting Marco together and stealing supplies, what's the point of putting her on his ship?
That is what we call in this business an arc, Jim. You make this little sheepish girl completely helpless at war to the extent that her family needs to get rid of her to protect her. And then you throw her into a situation where she's going to be in three times the danger. And in that crucible, she's going to have to turn into a diamond and you're going to get your macho Peru.
But that would be insane. That's exactly what they're saying they don't want to do, right? Like, that's why Drummer is feeling him out here, to determine if Michio is going to be in more or less danger if she goes on his ship.
No,
if she determines
it.
She's going to be in more danger, she just won't send her on that ship, right? That would be insane.
This is putting the kid that can't dribble from Hoosiers in at the last minute in the semi-championship game, and instead of him collapsing, he sinks to three for, you know, it's like, yeah, like, but it's, this is, that's a story that you could tell, you know.
I don't know. This is like taking the kid from Hoosiers who can't dribble and saying, oh shit, we're going to be in the championship game. Maybe we should get him on a team that isn't going to be in the championship game. And then you find out that the other team you were planning to ship him to is in fact going to be in the championship game. So,
right. And he's their star player. Yeah, I get. Yeah.
So
but it does feel
why
like
would you
a,
trade
an
him?
Arc, maybe. Maybe the thing that was holding her back is her love. Like, she was so afraid of screwing up because it would mean the death of her family. And now she's on a strange ship and she could just be a soldier. And not
oh, sure.
Be
yeah.
The fan. Like, I think I can squint and see an arc where she turns out to be a badass that's kind of like, you know, a proto drummer. I don't think she can be drummer in four episodes, but
no. I mean,
like,
I'm
not pushing the wrong fucking
her.
Button and fucking up everyone's ambush and plan. Like, I think that's the arc that they got her on.
Yeah. If I'm drummer, I at least put her on someone else's, put somebody else's finger on that button. But yeah.
I can tell you fucking book readers, you love this macho Peru, and they're not going to let her go. They're not going to let her be disrespected. They're not going to let her shuffle off into the side of the board.
Macho Peru is definitely no Michio Pa, I'll tell you that.
I do love a lot of, like, I consistently love how much Drummer in retrospect loves Ashford. Like, you know, the obvious pride she takes piloting his ship, and the, you know, it's hard as a coffin nail and twice as sharp, just like Ashford. I miss Ashford. He's a good character.
The other possibility here is that Walker is not actually going to go in with him and pirate shit from Marco and hit those depots himself. He's actually just going to keep doing his thing and give Drummer the information that she needs to go do it. And that would make sense to still trade Michio off.
Telling you gotta get Macho Peru into action, though. She's going to see some action. She's going to push a button.
I think we can let her
right
go.
Button this time.
And then the last scene of the series is, you know, Drummer coming back, making good on the promise, I'll come back for you. Heartfelt.
Macho's just sitting there knitting socks on Epidus.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. Mildly interesting. Let's move on to Philip making final arrangements for the family of his friend that he killed last episode. I don't know what this kid's name. The kid had 3 minutes of horn dog acting and he got blown away. But that guy,
Philip, says his name twice in this episode. I can't decipher it because we have no subtitles and the internet doesn't even know this guy exists yet. So
right.
Yeah,
it's tough. It's tough because I tried to look up Irizami, like, you know, because I like, you know, looking into the lore behind the names. They usually mean something. Sometimes they don't. Like last season, there was someone named after a school administrator in the LA County school system. Like, right. So I couldn't find any good hits, solid hits for that. But by the way, if you know what Irizami they're getting at with that, let me know. expanse@baldmove.com. I'd love to share it with the fan base. But I have no idea what this kid's name is. But I think Philip's trying to do what he thinks a military commander in this situation would do, try to do right by him. And he's stymied by blonde Nazi poster girl, Belter, Renfield, Ringo, what's her name?
Rosenfeld. Yeah.
Rosenfeld. Boy, it's going to be a tough one for me to get, apparently.
Apparently.
But he just runs right up against a brick wall of her not giving a shit about anything. Mm-hmm. And his effect of like, oh, well, cool, never mind then. And then she kind of realizes like what a monster, and like, oh, this is actually, you know, Hitler's kid. Maybe I should ease up on the dick throttle a bit. And she's like, yeah, months of fuel pellets and a new mining net.
Yeah,
that's probably a pretty good haul for a poor Belter family. Yeah,
I guess. It seems like a small price for the life of your child, but yeah, sure. I guess beggars can't be choosers.
And if I put on my Belter goggles, this is like, you know, I'm thinking about Diogo's origin story of getting chucked out of an airlock because his crazy uncle went after a Martian patrol. And that all started because of their old shitty nets, you know, the whole thing, you know, that he had to like take all these safety precautions and Diogo didn't do it right and it fucked things up. And so like, I guess, you know, it's like a sheep and a two cows don't seem a lot for a remuneration for a dead child until you're like back in the Middle Ages, you know, and that's like a year's worth of pay. Right. So
sure.
Who knows?
Yeah. Seems like Philip is trying to swallow his guilt here. You know, after his dad and him had a talk.
And they show that too with him like imposing the death message to the family. Like the first one is Philip, and the second one is Farco, which is Philip's impression of what he.
Right. It's the first one is just Philip. Second one is Inaros.
I like Farco.
Farco, sure.
Him trying to be his dad, the Philip version of his dad.
What about Millip?
But Millip? Nah, Farco. Farco's definitely more Belter.
Yeah.
Before the assault on the Azure Dragon, UNN-1, the Zenobia, I like that. The fact that any ship that's got Avasarala is UNN-1. So it's nice. Nice touch to Earth history. Mm-hmm. It's buzzing with her military advisors having cows of all shapes and sizes about the fact that she's doing some kind of wild and crazy mission, and Monica's skulking around the bulkheads just soaking up all this information.
Monica just popping up everywhere. I love it.
Yeah. And then fuck it. Let's just talk about this whole battle from start to finish.
Okay.
Phase one, the sneak, which doesn't last very long. This is the, you know, this feels like a submarine movie where you're trying to approach the ship from the back behind your screws where they're sonar blind, and they fucking pull a crazy Ivan and they're onto you and they go rabbit. So then you get into the chase.
Well, I love the buildup to this, where they are trying to sneak up on him. The music is so good. It's got I don't even know how to describe it, but it has an almost underwater feel too, right? It's like these subdued electronica sounds that you would think of as Belter music, I imagine.
And you got the crew preparing, like they're getting on, you know, their spacesuit ready to do battle in zero G, and you know, there's significant the first time I was watching, I'm like, what the fuck is going on with Naomi? Because like I was starting to feel like, man, this is starting to get back to smug, self-righteous season two Naomi, which I thought we were kind of done with. But it turns out that she probably just had some, you know, suppressed trauma from all the shit she dealt with last season and starting to bubble. Amos fucking around with Bobby about the Goliath suits, you know, the like, hey, where can I get me one of them? Oh, it'll break you in half, Pee-wee. I read book five just the other week, and I was surprised to see what I would consider like pretty obvious sexual tension between Alex and Bobby in that book.
Yeah.
And I remember in season three, like, you know, there was a little bit of light flirtation going on with Bobby and Alex. Is that a thing in the books, and are they transferring that to Amos? Because I don't know, maybe Bobby just flirts with everybody.
I can't remember how often she flirts, but no, it's not a thing in the books.
Just don't worry your pretty little head about it.
Books swing pretty far afield of romance in the final goings.
Yeah. It's hard to fuck when you got all this this war on.
Yeah.
Unless you're Philip.
I mean, that's not true. Alex does go to a bar and get laid in book six pretty early on.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
That's pretty much every. I think
but it's not Bobby.
Amos visits a brothel right. in almost every book.
For sure.
But yeah, they have they also deploy like this. Bobby kind of referred to it obliquely as the thing that she's got to cut the engines. And it turns out that's an EMP device. They're getting that ready. Mm-hmm. And then when they rabbit Holden, you know, punches it and everyone just crumples through the deck, except Bobby in her power armor.
Fuck yeah.
Which is so like that's one of the coolest things is like the contrast between because Amos is like a immensely strong guy.
Yeah.
And he like, you know, with a great effort and screaming and yelling can get to his hands and knees. And Bobby is just with the strength of her power armor, just like, you know, like Naomi's plastered to the deck. She comes jetting down and just strides, picks up the EMP.
Yeah. It's and it's badass.
Also like the way they're making these breakneck maneuvers. Uh-huh. Like there's some real danger there. Like Bobby, like, you know, sizes up the second and the second her trajectory matches, she just jumps for it
mm-hmm.
and does her Spider Woman routine on the side of that thing and cuts its engines. That I thought that was even more badass than the actual assault, like her just doing that leap of faith.
Yeah, no, the whole thing is super cool. I absolutely love seeing Bobby just kind of walking around in multi-G burns. Yeah, and that jump, I was holding my breath during that jump because, like, I think, you know, Bobby jumps out there. She's probably got some boosters. I think we've seen boosters on her suit before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're firing.
She could
sure.
get back in, but she's not. But probably lost. Not going to get another chance at this, right? They're going to have to wait to pick her up or leave her there, which is
because it's also a idea. Race. Like Marco's people, clearly, like we find this later on, but they're in a race on inside to try to the blow delete the core or delete it yeah. and, you know, get rid of because they know and uh-huh. they it's not like they have a chance to reset up for this. This is like no. you got like a and once there's like a constant clock under all this, like once the EMP goes off, like the ship goes dead, but you start to see the running lights come back on and Bobby's suit rebooting, like, and they even mm-hmm. say, like, for the dumb people, you know, us getting back in and running means that they inside must be getting close to being right. back and running. So they have to cut the power for real. They have to blow. It's a great scene. And things go wrong, like the belters mm-hmm. go out and they start, you know, there's these small arms fires, got no threat to Bobby, but right. they're smart. That's just a decoy operation for the guy with the handheld rocket launcher to come and cut her in half.
Yeah.
And Clarissa puts a stop to that.
Yeah, no, it's great. And then Naomi malfunctions a bit.
I've always heard about how dangerous it is to throw up in your suit, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, I thought the fishbowl effect of the vomit and like, you know, how like that's a medical emergency, man, mm-hmm. In zero G. And that takes because like you already had Naomi scratched. Now, like, you know, Bobby's supposed to be the one that breaches and goes in here. Invincible Bobby. Now it's like Holden and Amos. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, this is the last season. And I don't know what happens in the books. Like, fuck, it's been a long time since they killed like a real main character. Like, maybe yeah. it's going to. So, like,
also, the thing I kept worrying about is that they were going to get the Azure Dragon fired back up and just take off because if you look at that scene, and like nobody's left on sure. on the Rossi. Nobody.
Right. Right. I mean, yeah.
Naomi, I think, is the only. Naomi is on the Rossi. I just thinking, man, they're not going to get these. They're not going to get their people back if this happens.
And if you fall off, you hit the drive cone. We see how bad the radiation to kill you. Like, yeah. And like if I'm the belters and I get that the reactor fired back up, I just dump it and blow it. The sec. So like.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, I totally. Felt the ticking clock, and I found mm-hmm. this extremely exciting. This show does action scenes, especially that space action, like them trying to, like, you know, turn and run and lose it. Because, like, that's the other thing, is they know the Ross and I's going to blow them up, because if they wanted to, would have done it already. So, like, right. they know, like, they just have to run. They have to do. Man, it's great. It's a great scene.
When Peaches uses her mod, I was a little confused as to why she would use it. Because they don't show like what she's looking at. She just kind of looks over and then uses it. I'm like, well, mm-hmm. Bobby just shot the two threats right there. And then she's already dealt with the problem before we even realize there is a problem, which I love that little detail.
Helmet off.
Right? She goes in and just goes berserk, tears this dude in half, almost literally. And before we even see it, and I love that moment, before Bobby even sees it, right?
And it was good. A great, also like Bobby being surprised by this giant red gash in the hull of the ship. Like, I don't know what, like they say it's a rocket. I wish they did a better job like selling that guy as a heavy, like a heavy weapons guy. Like I needed that gun to be like twice as long and bulkier. Because I'm just
I need like
oh,
magnetic mounts. I need shit that you have to like
something
strap to the ship, right? Magnetically and fire.
Because it didn't read as an obvious threat to me.
Right.
But it was a solid plan to have essentially the two belters sacrifice themselves to draw the fire of the Martian Marine while the third guy comes with a skill shot. And if it hadn't been for Clarissa, which this is the mechanism they're going to use to make everything all right on the ship.
Right.
But yeah, Naomi makes quick work of the encryption on the hasty encryption on the Azure Dragon, and they get what can only be described as what Holden says. It's a mother load. Like it looks like hundreds of rocks, green and red. I imagine the red ones are things they've already done and the green ones are the active ones ton of rocks.
The thing is, it tells you exactly which ones have been armed.
Yep. And so this is like months, if not years of effort that Marco has got to keep the Earth pinned down. And now it's all going to be undone.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big turning point in the war, it feels like. So back on UNN1, the Zenobia, Avasarala gives Monica a very special assignment.
Actually, before we move on, we should all state that like the ship is the one that was sending the signals out to actually activate these things. I don't think that Marco can remotely do that. So I think by also taking out this ship or capturing this ship, they've eliminated Marco's ability to throw rocks at all. It's not even he could push a button and they could go at once and cause a problem for another week or so. No, it's like he can't do anything with these weapons anymore.
Yeah, and he'd have to build it all from scratch if he wanted to.
The fleet's chasing
you down. Yeah,
that's the big thing. The fleet is off the leash.
And he never had, in my understanding, he never had the numbers.
No.
Like if Earth and Mars united with everything they got that they're going to, but like it's just keeping them busy. And like has he bought his fleet enough time to do whatever the fuck they need to do to win permanently?
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. So back on the Zenobia, Avasarala gives Monica a special assignment, which is a very particular story that she wants told.
Oh, that's the description. Yeah. My favorite line of the episode is in this. My favorite two lines, actually, where Monica tells Christian that she gives a really good guilt trip. That was good. And then Christian responds with, I practice a lot when I'm alone. That is such a Christian thing to do, right?
That's a consistent that's a very consistent thing that the show, like the Avasarala is kind of reluctant. That she's like, you know, back when I was younger, I used to think that, you know, this kind of shit was beneath it. It's a toilless and thankful work. But then I realized there's only a limited amount of adults in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're one of them, you kind of have to step up. And that's like, I think she gives her that speech every fucking day. You know, like this is obviously hard. It's a thankless job. She doesn't particularly relish, especially the political things that go along with it. But God damn it, she's the adult in the room and she's the best woman for the job. She's got to do it. And she passes that buck along to other people as often as she can get.
Sure.
So I thought it was nice. It reminded me, echoed to that, you know, I think speech she gave to Holden, because when Holden was starting to whine about it being too tough for, you know, back in season three, because he went through a brief arc of like, you know what? Yeah, when he was in and she had just fled the clutches of Mao on the Razorback and
Cody R.
And Holden's like, you know, I've tried to do good and it's all just fucked up. And, you know, he just wanted to quit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a good speech. And I like the idea. It's funny. Like, I got a kick out of it because, of course, you know, you and I have been working for some months now on this Barry Belt of Christmas that everything's gone well. We launched sometime this week, or maybe next week,
or last week. Who knows?
Yeah, we conceived it as like, because there's the line where Avasarala, you know, like Monica's like, well, you've got people to do this kind of propaganda piece. And she's like, you know, said something along the lines, yes, and if I've got some space herpes or, you know, some new thing I want, like those people are fine for it. But I need, and because that's exactly what we produce. Like, this is
right
pre Marco throwing rocks, the UN trying to, you know, induce cooperation amongst the peoples of the, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, what we did is not what Monica's doing. We did the shitty space herpes PSA version of whatever Monica's going to do. But I think it
has more weight coming from Monica, right? I mean, she's the person who's been following Holden and the proto molecule, and she has her career has been immensely boosted. Her, I guess, clout and the respect she gets from people over the last few seasons. So, yeah, coming from her, it's going to feel like more valuable to people, more honest, more real.
Yeah, you think about, like, you know, how much kind of power that certain, you know, reporters get when they're reporting from a war scene or and you know, she cut her teeth as, you know, the pirate free radio on board the Behemoth when things were going down in the Ring Gate. And she's been like they said, this trusted source of information about, like, this fair and balanced reporting about, you know, what's going on between the Belt and Earth and Mars. And that's a two-edged sword because, like, you know, she points out, it's like, you know, people trust me for a reason, and I'm not going to let you use my good name to bullshit. And obviously I was like, but I'm not asking you to lie. I want you to tell a full and accurate version of the truth, which she feels will suit her needs, which is, like, to slow down Marco's war effort. You know, if you can just peel off a few Belters and make him feel sorry for Earth rather than, you know, vindicated, justified, then that's going to make Marco's, you know, that's going to make his life a hell of a lot harder.
Sure.
And I think it'll work. I do kind of cringe because it seems like they're going to have to do a version of this thing. And anytime, like, you know, we've talked about this before, anytime, like, a TV show sets out to make a hit pop show, pop music, or this came up in Mad Men, you know, these supposed to be the best advertisers in the world. Like, it's got to feel like that's is a good ad, right? Like, you hear it, like, fuck yeah, I want to buy Heinz ketchup.
Yeah.
Monica's going to have to do, like, a really good devastation of the Earth thing that they can show for 30 seconds, I think. And it's got to be good and not cringy, like, right?
Yeah. No. Yeah, I don't know if we'll ever see it. Maybe we'll see it.
Is this a book plot?
I thought Holden did something like this in one of the books where he was trying to sympathize the it was the other way, though. I thought he was, like, trying to get Belter stories together, even closer to what we're doing with Very Belter Christmas. Yeah. To get them to understand each other. I can't remember. It's been a while.
I wondered if this was a book six plot, because it's another thing where it's like, I can see why Avasarala is doing this, but, like, what does it look like in terms of story? You know, like, is this just going to be something where we see Monica with a microphone and, like, a tear running down her face, like, cutting, like, this is Monica signing off.
Right. Arms and an angel is like, playing.
Oh, sure. That's exactly. There's no way the Belt can hate us after they've seen. And then, like, then the tide starts turning them. How is this? Like, Bobby's mission, yeah, as soon as I heard it, I'm like, fuck yeah, this is going to be awesome. It's going to be a special effects thing. It's going to be this, it's going to be that. Gets a crew to get Monica, like, yeah, the
this
fuck?
Is hard,
like,
to pull off.
Her special, yeah, what's that look like?
It's nice in juxtaposition to the news feed we saw at the beginning of last episode, right? Kind of catching us up for the 6 months where it's all, like, anguish and anger and despair and all that stuff.
I also, there's a little production element I noticed. There's seal of the UN, or at least of the Secretary General's. I don't think I've seen the full thing, but there's a Latin motto at the bottom, presumably there's something at the top, but it's Tellura Una, which I think is Latin for we are all one Earth. Which I thought was, you know, it's exactly kind of Latin shit that they'd have in a seal like that. I was hoping to get a full shot of it so I could see what the full phrase was, but cool. I like that they do that stuff. I love that they, you know, pay attention to that kind of detail. Then finally, well, I guess not finally, Holden visits Peaches in the Rossley sick bay to give her an official ass chewing for improvising on their last mission. An ass chewing that seems to cement her as part of the official crew of the Rocinante. So it's,
I was
going to
say, she didn't get the ass chewing part of this scene. She just got the Holden likes me now part of this scene,
which was funny. That's like, yeah. It's, her and Amos are pretty cute.
For sure.
And Amos is thrilled that now she's becoming at least, you know, one more. I don't know if she's won over Naomi.
Mm.
Although I guess like she's kind of got to be, because that mission would have gone all kinds of pear shaped if it hadn't been for her. So maybe she's won them both over.
And she was going out as a pair with Claire, I think.
Right.
Kind of working
in tandem
still with her.
Not making eye contact with her. Yeah. Still like, you know, being standoffish. And now I wonder, although I guess it could go the other way. It's like maybe she feels that Clarissa showed her up, you know, like she was supposed to do the job and she froze up.
And I don't know. That doesn't
seem
like
an asshole way to take it. But, you know, people do weird shit.
Sure.
But yeah, but here's the thing about Holden. Okay, genius. She radios you to talk about like what should happen. I mean, I'm kind of like, I don't know what kind of ass chewing you give, because like if she'd done anything else than what she'd done, one or more people die.
That's the thing. Like, you got to make split second decisions, and you don't always have time to radio back through the chain of command, get them to decide without eyes on the situation. And yeah, it's tough.
And that's not how this crew always works, to be clear.
Oh,
like,
no.
This is kind of a first, much more first among equals kind of thing. And yes, you're right. In a life or death situation, they kind of all defer to Holden because mutual assent. But like, you know, we've seen Amos make calls. We've seen Alex make calls. We've certainly seen Naomi make calls in the heat of the moment. And I just, but it doesn't matter, because what matters is she accepts the ass chewing, even though she probably could have bucked against it. And that shows that, you know, she's picking up what I guess Holden's putting down. Finally, our final scene, Marco finds out about the loss of the Azure Dragon and prepares a welcoming committee for the inner fleets that he assumes will be burning to Ceres Station to retake what is they see as rightfully theirs. First off, do you agree with this tactical assessment that the Earth is going to be obsessed with getting Ceres Station back?
I don't know. Why is Earth so obsessed with Ceres? Is it because of what it represents to the belt?
It was a big experience. Like, Tyco Corporation spinning that thing up kind of made it. I think it is definitely like if there's a capital of the belt, it probably is that. It's the largest facility, most sophisticated
is
facility.
Is it the most within reach? I mean, you had like a...
I mean, it is very close.
It's Star Helix being there is kind of like a middle point between Earth and the belt, right?
Yeah. It's and like that's what really separates already. The inners from the belt is the demarcation line between the inner and the outer planets. So,
oh yeah. I mean,
I don't know. I mean, I think if Ava Sorrell is playing a smart political game, she would essentially say, we respect the belters' right for independence and self-organization and Ceres, because even before Marco took it over, Anderson Dawes had taken it over more or less with the consent, you know, like Earth is like, all right, you and Fred Johnson, you're in charge of the belt and we're gonna so like I think the smart play would be to like let the belt, like let Ceres decide and wait for Marco's starvation tactics to set in, and then I bet Ceres welcomes them, you know, like especially if Drummer's at the head of the rescue fleet. I mean, that's what needs to happen. They need to make this a true everybody's in on this, and probably Drummer needs to be the fleet commander. That would be the politically smart thing to do.
I don't know. We'll see. I can't say too much.
Yeah. I also thought that Marco seemed very scared. Like shocked
well,
and
this
scared
is the
and
thing.
Like shitting his pants until it felt like a cope. When he started laughing and be like, "Eh, we've been wanting to battle anyway. Like, you kind of are fucked, dude."
That's
unless
Marco.
You got something real and Medina cooked up. Like, yeah.
They make that point about Marco, right? In I think it's season 5, Naomi's talking about Marco and how the next plan is whatever happens was always his plan all along, right? We We always expected that was just a distraction
on the real goal. If the goal works, then it's like it's the result of my brilliant. Yeah, he's always got a way to spin it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was always the plan, but you know, it wasn't always the plan, but now it's always the plan. It is kind of the thing. Like, oh yeah, of course. He jumps from one plane to the next.
Because like if they are doing an all out war at series, that might be the biggest fleet battle we ever see. And like I think this show has talked around a fleet battle a lot more than actually shown it, you know? Like, you know, we've seen the beginnings of one, we've seen the ends of one, we've seen like what was going to be a big fleet battle was going to be huge,
yeah.
But even then, that's like before half the dozen slow capital zone. Ships and
true.
And there's a couple, but like we might get like a full scale fleet engagement, which that would be pretty sexy. But we'll see.
Yeah.
That's it for this episode. You got anything else you want to talk about?
I do not.
Well, what do you guys and gals want to talk about? Our tight beam receptor is wide open at expanse@baldmove.com. If you'd like to send us a message, we will be doing a dedicated feedback episode next week to kind of catch up. And again, then we'll be, you know, weekly on episode 3 and 4. That'll get us past Christmas into the new year. We'll do another standalone catch up episode, and we'll probably continue to do a single episode and a separate feedback episode for the Expanse. Because that's worked so well on other shows that we've had screeners for, because that lets us, you know, keep the episodes fresh in mind, and it makes sure we don't get our email like goofed up 2 weeks later, whatever. So that's our understanding. So we should be able to get to it next week. Thanks to everybody that has reached out to us. Expanse@baldmove.com. We'll be back next Thursday or early Friday morning, date and time, ready with another fresh episode of Delta Loda for you after the episode. We'll see you then. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.